This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am one of your hosts, Mark Oppenheimer, joined by a couple others. Tablet Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy V-Day. And Tablet Editor-at-Large Liel Leibowitz.
Mazel Valentine.
And it is known as Tu B'Av, where you are from, but here there's more chocolate. And today on the show, our Jew of the Week is a return guest, the author David Sachs, who I think is a prophet. He joins us to talk about his book, The Future is Analog, How to Create a More Human World. And the GOTW, the Gentile of the Week, is another prophet, Bill Finnegan, who talked with me about surfing and also how to report on war and poverty. Two things he does really well.
At the same time.
At the same time, which is why I love him. But before we get to that—
Everybody go surfing in impoverished USA.
We are recording on Valentine's Day to air— Day after, Morgan Valentine's Day, as they would say in German.
Valentine's Day.
Motzi Morgan.
And there, I just, two things I want to say about this. One is people will often say, like, do you have a beautiful Valentine's Day tradition with that, you know, beautiful wife and this beautiful
family? I do.
Are people not often saying that
often,
to you?
My beautiful Valentine's Day tradition is not fucking celebrating Valentine's Day. The most goyish of all. Could we agree? There is no more goyish.
Sounds like Mark has a tradition.
Commemoration.
We have a tradition. Sounds like Mark has a tradition.
Well, to be fair, people don't say it in that weird, creepy voice I just used, but people often say, oh, what are you doing for Valentine's Day? And the answer is the same thing we do for our anniversary. Nothing.
Right.
But somehow the tradition developed of buying our kids a little pack of gum for Valentine's Day. I think I did it when they each get like a 50-cent pack of Wrigley's Spearmint
like
or
five
Juicy
piece,
Fruit.
The five long skinny pieces, yeah.
That's right. And the five long skinny pieces. And for $3, I've made my kids happier than
by
anything.
The way,
gum to them is smack.
What an amazing commercial opportunity. Themed Valentine's Day candy, but not for lovers saying, will you be mine? But for kids saying, thanks a lot. Yeah, things are really romantic since you came along.
Haven't spent 5 minutes alone with your mother.
Can't remember last time I was together with my spouse.
It's kind of true.
I hope you're feeling grateful. Someone please do this for me. By the way, do we know anything about Valentine's? Because I'm going to go ahead right now out of the depths of my ignorance.
That St. Valentine's was a
raging guy. Raging guy.
Yeah, I don't think it ends well. Like, right. And the bow and arrow was actually not for love. It was like to hunt down Jews. And now look at us. We're like, we're just like everyone else. We send Valentine's too.
The original Valentine's Day involved burning down synagogues.
The Valentines were actually notes being like, I'm going
to
kill you.
It was actually, you took your beloved to a date where you watched a Jew being slaughtered. Like, let's go watch a Jew being thrown to the lions.
Yeah, let's keep Saint and Saint Valentine's Day.
Anna was complaining yesterday that it's unfair that her Jewish day school doesn't celebrate Saint Valentine's Day. And she said, I mean, Saint Patrick's Day, I understand because it's like religious. But Saint Valentine's Day, just because the word saint is in it doesn't mean it's religious. It's for everybody. And I do want to give a shout out, though, to my brother, Daniel James Oppenheimer, who years ago when he lived in the city, a bunch of friends and he, for like maybe 3 years this tradition lasted, had a tradition of having a turkey for what they called Thanksgiving on Valentine's Day. Because Dan's belief was Thanksgiving's the best holiday because it's warm and inclusive and anyone can do it. And it's not, he just felt no baggage for Thanksgiving. Whereas Valentine's Day, if you didn't have a beloved, you felt like an asshole.
So it's friends Valentine's
Yeah,
Day?
So it was like Friendsgiving. So for Valentine's Day, he'd have a massive party where he would cook a big turkey.
That's so nice.
And it was actually very sweet, and he was always proselytizing for it. And I think he has stopped proselytizing for it, but I want to pick up the—
Can I TMI and tell you my Valentine's Day plans?
We would love nothing more.
So for my birthday, my mother-in-law got me a massage gift certificate. And I was like, thank you so much. This is so nice. When am I going to use this? I haven't used it. My birthday was in September. I went on the website to look around. I'm getting a massage tonight at 5:00. Put it on the shared calendar. And Ben was like, what are you, what? You're
That's
doing
awesome.
What? And I was like, you'll take Edith tonight.
Because nothing says love more than I'm going to go away for a couple hours and like, just be in complete solitude.
I was like,
solitude.
Well, your mom got this for me, so I'm going to do it tonight.
She wants me to.
Yeah.
This was for my wellness.
Isn't this great that, like, the older you get, your idea of, like, what makes for, like, this perfect glowing evening?
Being alone.
Like, at this point, my perfect evening is absolutely no commitments and no reason to be and extra points if I was supposed to have plans.
And then someone else canceled.
At 3 p.m. and said, I'm really sorry, something came up. This is like
What saint is that? Like Saint Flake.
It's like Saint Golda.
Someone else cancels your plans on you. And
it's
you're like,
greatest gift.
Especially if you were actually like going to go.
I know.
You weren't even planning on canceling yourself.
And now hours has opened up. That can also happen when you come down with a sickness that's not too bad.
Yeah,
like a little, like a cold that's bad enough that you can legitimately say to everyone, I can't do anything for 2 days. Yeah. I'm just going to have to lie in bed and watch watch Last Tango in Halifax, by the way, one of the shows recommended for you because there's a vicarage and there are British people with plummy accents. And
St. Vicar's Day.
And longtime fan Emily Moore recommended it. And having finished with Grantchester, we have moved on to Last Tango in Halifax. And nothing says bliss.
Even
like
the name Grantchester, it reads like ChatGPT. Like it's an AI directed.
Of what we
it's
think.
It's like, hey, AI, bring me a
show with
English
a vicar.
Murder.
Right. So speaking of Jews, because that's what we do, I think we all have to give a big shout out to the Jewish community of Ann Arbor, Michigan, where we just were for a truly splendid 24 hours. And we haven't been on the road a lot. We're back on the road and people should bring us on the road. But Ann Arbor memories, Stephanie?
Okay, so Ann Arbor was very fun. We got to hang out with some old friends, some new friends, and we were part of the main event, a big Federation event in town. And after the show, we do what we always do, which is like find a place that's open late and get like a disgusting amount
the
of
food.
Yeah.
Absolute like, revolting.
Like just so gross.
Yeah. Listener, whatever you imagine, it's precisely what we ordered.
Right.
So two things happen at dinner. We go to Hopcat, like a bar, like a, and this is a college town. So it's not actually, sometimes it's actually quite hard to find a place that's open at like 9.
not in Ann Arbor,
yeah,
Michigan
not in Ann Arbor.
On a
we
Thursday.
Were like, they were like, I don't know if we have room for you here. But so we were there, we ordered a hunk.
Like, we're cool.
So basically this.
Hello,
this,
fellow kids.
This waitress comes over. She takes our order for like 100 sets of beer battered fries. Officially, it was too many fries. I
100
did not know
beers and 100 orders of
beer
battered fries.
Exactly. And so
I'm sorry, I have a reputation to uphold here. Two martinis.
Yes, yes,
never,
it's
never
true.
Beers.
I
true.
Witnessed it. It was funny because at the event, they had all these really fun stickers that they were giving out to people. And some of them said like podcast listeners. Some of them said like my first main event at Ann Arbor. And then there was one that said, I love my Jew crew. So I obviously was wearing a few of them. One of them was that. And so the waitress comes next to me to order. And I sort of like did this weird thing that I'm going to come clean about. I took the stickers off and put them on my leg from my shirt to my leg. Because I was like, you know, I'm wearing a sticker that says, I heart my Jew crew.
Just in case the waitress is a follower of St. Valentine's.
Yes,
and therefore
exactly.
Wants
and has
to
her, has her quiver, you know, yeah. Has her quiver ready for me. And so after she does the order, she comes around and she says, by any chance, do you guys host a podcast? And I said, yes, because one of the stickers on my leg said podcast person. And then she says, and is it by any chance about how much you love your Jew crew? And I was like, weirdly, yes. And she says, look at my ring. She pulls out her ring that has tiny Hebrew letters on. I actually can't read it. I don't know if it was because the ring was like the letters were really small. But it said chesed.
Right. It said chesed. I was trying to remember what it said.
Loving
yeah.
kindness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was like, I took a religion. I was a religious studies minor.
She was a comparative religion minor at the University of Michigan. And her name is Kat. And she's the star waitress.
She loves Jews.
Top Kat.
She knows more about Judaism yeah. than like most people.
Yep.
And so we just had the most fun time with her.
She was amazing. And she
loved Kat.
And I mean, she was one of those waitresses who did that great thing where she just started ignoring her other tables. And
yes.
I mean, if you're her manager, please understand that she was actually serving the greater good by spending time with us because we were a big group. We stayed late. We spent a lot of money. She was serving the people. But did she ignore a couple other tables to talk religion with us? She did.
My favorite bit, of course, was when she asked, so what goes on your podcast? And me being several martinis in. Said, oh, Holocaust jokes. And poor Kat, just the look on her face. She's like, I don't know how to react to that.
She sort of stifled
Am I
a
laughing?
Laugh.
Am yeah. I walking away quietly? I don't know. Is this a test?
There was one of those...
like, can I laugh?
Stifled a laugh and then like was unclear if she could laugh. And then we said, it's okay, you
like,
can
permission
laugh.
Permission to laugh, Kat.
Permission to laugh, Kat. And she's... I think she's, it'll be 2 years from now when her own podcast is dominating the Spotify religion chart. So
right.
if
awesome.
You're in Ann Arbor, go say hi to Kat. Tell her the Jew crew loves her.
Shout out to Oren, who was there also and came up to us a little bit after. I was like, I was just at the event. My grandma is obsessed with you guys. She told me to go.
I will say things did not go quite so well for me because I was very excited to see my dear friend, Andy Markowitz, who's on the show, wrote this amazing book that I still obsess over, Passport as Home, about the joys of being a ruthless cosmopolitan. Beautiful memoir. And we have an hour before the show. And Andy says, why don't you meet me at Bistro Zola? And I'm thinking, Bistro Zola is such a particular name. I'm just going to put it in the Google Maps. I'm just going to go to Bistro Zola. I go to Bistro Zola, and I'm delighted to see that it's right by our hotel. And I go and I wait, and Andy's texting me, where are you? And I say, I'm here at the bar. And he's like, no, I'm at the bar. It's like, but the restaurant's empty. It was like one of these Twilight Zone type of moments.
You're like, do I exist?
And for 3 minutes, I was like, is this like a time-space continuum issue?
Am I being
like,
punked? Where's Ashton?
Have this Jewish space lasers kicked in? I don't know. And so then I take out the phone. Turns out there are two Bistro Zolas, which I actually don't think are related to each other. 11 miles apart.
There's the one you don't go to.
Miles.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the most Jewish things. Like, oh, that Bistro Zola?
When you saw Andy, did you say, j'accuse of sending me to the wrong Bistro
like,
Zola?
No, I felt like Dreyfus myself.
Do you feel, you felt like a true ruralist cosmopolitan?
Completely.
Because you couldn't had no roots.
However, you did not order the drink that Stephanie invented that night at the live show, the rootless cosmopolitan, the best name for a Jewish drink ever. If we got nothing else out of Ann Arbor, and we got lots out of Ann Arbor, it is the fact that we have to come up with a recipe for the rootless cosmopolitan. What makes a Cosmo rootless?
I would say it's just a Cosmo, maybe with a drop of a blood of a Christian child.
I was going to say like a stemless martini glass, but you go off.
Listeners, if you have other thoughts on how to make a rootless cosmopolitan, write to us at unorthodox@tabletmag.com.
News of the Jews.
News of the Jews. So you guys went to see Bernard-Henri Lévy during the Super Bowl?
Before the Super Bowl.
Nathan Sharansky.
Okay.
It was
I
the Jewish
actually
Super Bowl.
Went to a Super Bowl party at Rabbi Skolnick's house in Hamden.
The other Jewish Super Bowl.
The other Jewish Super Bowl with the other rabbi because his granddaughter is in my daughter's class. And we went and there was food and beers. And a game was on, which I didn't watch, but I stood around and like heard people holler. And apparently during the game, there were some ads shown because all people care about is the ads, right? And some of the ads were these Christian ads from this billion-dollar ad campaign that has the Jewosphere and the Christosphere in all, you know, all aflame with questions. The ads were put out by this nonpartisan, ecumenical Christian community basically saying, what was the tagline? It was like,
Jesus, he gets us.
He gets us, right? And for some reason, the idea that Christians would actually spread the faith, which is, you know, the thing that actually they do.
Christians do.
That Christians do. Always.
It's kind of the brand, you know?
Always shocks some people who then say, how dare they proselytize me? Whereas I'm like, bring it on. I always invited the missionaries in for a Coke when I was a kid. Drove my parents crazy. AOC tweeted something like, way to put a pretty face on fascism. Did you see that too?
Sure.
Like, because there were people in the ads hugging each other and
faith equals fascism for the communists. That goes without saying.
But all I could think was, you know, that it is time for Jews to come up with our own ad campaign. And one of my favorite bits of obnoxious
Rav Nachman. He gets us?
Moshiach, Moshiach, Moshiach.
We get him.
I don't know. You know, there is this canard in Judaism that we are somehow prohibited from proselytizing. And we're not. It's just we never did because historically, if we did.
We would be, killed.
They would kill us.
The local, murdered.
The local prince or duchy or whatever.
Vicar
would have us slain. So
St. Valentine's.
We have good reason for not going out and trying to, you know, proselytize to the people who allow us to live on their lands. But we can. We could take out a Super Bowl ad. We could take out a Stanley Cup ad.
Why not just do it during the live broadcast of the Nobel Prize announcements? That would be on brand.
What if it's like an Elijah type thing where it's like, open the door? I don't know. No, that doesn't seem. Workshop it.
The ad. Did you guys watch the ads, by the way? The ads are actually quite beautiful. They don't really, it's one of those things where you don't know what you're watching.
Did it work?
It's a lot of, guys, I have something to something to tell you.
What aren't those ads like that
yours
you see around that are like kindness? Pass it on.
What are those?
You're like, I don't want to go.
The more you know.
Yeah.
The more
you know. You're like, I don't want to go to that website.
What would a Jewish Super Bowl ad?
The Jewish
be?
Super Bowl ad would be.
Mark, you had some good ideas.
I had some good. Okay, so my idea was that the tagline instead of "He gets us," which is the Jesus one, would be "You're welcome." Like, look what we've done for you. Yeah. Like, Diana, what? That's not good enough. So it would be like, we gave you the weekend. You're welcome. Like, it'll be a whole thing about someone slaving away for 5 days and just suffering and on the commute.
Monotheism.
And finally gets back and
it's
Friday night and they get to power down.
Lactose intolerance. You're welcome?
It's lactane. No, it's actually, it's like
you're welcome.
Tofutti cuties. You're welcome.
You're welcome.
That was literally a Jewish invention. I like that because it kind of sounds like,
you're welcome.
If you know where my head's at, it's like the Moana song. It's like when Dwayne Johnson sings "You're Welcome," but instead of like all the things that Moana should be thankful for, it's like all the things the Gentiles should be thankful for.
Totally. Totally. And I think
I like
I mean,
that. You're welcome. When
Jesus.
You're welcome. Right.
What was the, there was some like old ditty. I don't know who it was. The line was Marx, Einstein, something, and Freud. No wonder the Gentiles are annoyed. And it was like all these people that the Jews gave us.
Marx, Einstein, George Santos, and Freud.
What about that? That would be our ad. George Santos. He's not one of us.
Speaking of George Santos, this just keeps coming. They just keep claiming to be Jews. In the news this week, Republican Representative Ana Paulina Luna claimed she was Jewish. Some relatives.
Can you say her name again and slow? Because the name itself is poetry.
Ana Paulina Luna. Ana Paulina Luna. It is a beautiful name. Republican representative, I'm reading from Insider, Ana Paulina Luna of Florida may have misrepresented her religious background and only recently began identifying as Hispanic, according to the Washington Post. Luna, just elected to Congress from Florida's 13th, said in an interview with Jewish Insider in November that her father raised her as a Messianic Jew, a person that identifies as Jewish and who believes Jesus is the Messiah. I was raised as a Messianic Jew by my father, said Luna. I'm also a small fraction Ashkenazi. And this is like the new I want to print up little buttons that say small fraction Ashkenazi. Like a smidge, abyssal Ashkenazi.
23 and Jew.
That's right. Abyssal Ashkenazi.
I love that. I love that. Yeah. I was raised as a Messianic Jew. I am also a small fraction Ashkenazi. That's like amazing.
I'm everything. I'm just everything. It's just oneness.
I'm an everything bagel.
I like this is a really good George Santos reboot. You know, with a woman lead, strong
yes,
female
yes.
protagonist.
Yeah. Throw in the messianic thing
great,
here. Confuse
great,
us all.
Confuse us all.
Great
I love
sequel
this.
To the thing.
But you know, this Mark, this like, hits on your thing about like people want to be Jewish. People want to be a small fraction.
Everyone
of some
wants
Jewish
to be
lineage.
A small fraction. Anything.
Yeah.
Right. If you could be. If your great 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 grandfather could be an axe murderer, that's cool. Right. Everyone wants to be a small fraction Jewish murderer. Native American. There's no bad thing to be a little bit of. It just gives you some flavor.
You didn't read the second line of the headline, which is some relatives question that, the idea that she was raised Jewish, and say her grandfather fought for the Nazis. It's like, right. Guys, you got to do some oppo on before you run.
Maybe nobody wants to be a small fraction that. A small fraction
It was actually a small fraction Nazi, not Ashkenazi.
Also this week in News of the Jews, a lot of people talking about this really, really interesting news from Barcelona, Spain, where the mayor has severed ties with the city of Tel Aviv. I actually wasn't aware that cities had ties with other cities. I don't actually...
They write letters to each other.
I don't actually know what that means. Like, I remember as a little kid, the whole sister city thing being very big, but I don't really know what it means. But maybe it's just symbolic. It's still quite significant. The Barcelona mayor severed ties with Tel Aviv, saying that they were practitioners of apartheid and Barcelona wanted nothing to do with them. You can read all about this in many major Jewish news outlets, but we happen to have a man on the street in Barcelona. Our colleague Ellie Blyer is there, and he went out and found some real live Jews of Barcelona to ask them what they thought of this.
Hey, it's Ellie. I'm out here on the streets of Barcelona to ask some local Jewish folks about what they think about Ada Colau, Barcelona's mayor, dropping Tel Aviv as Barcelona's twin city.
People have been talking of nothing else. More likely than not, it's got to do with the elections coming up in the city. It feels like she wanted to make some sort of gesture to keep this part of her base happy.
Of course, I cared. I was a little bit sad. But at the same time, I think it's important to remember that criticizing a government that also applies to Ada Colau's government is totally fair and legitimate.
I didn't really care because it doesn't really matter to me, to be honest. But I think that if this thing, it's not good for each side, so I don't understand also why to do this.
Yeah, honestly, I think it's sad. I think it's counterproductive for Barcelona to let go of a partnership with Tel Aviv when Tel Aviv has similar values to Barcelona. Why are European city governments even getting involved in criticism of specifically Israel? My aunt asked me, you know, why not Iran and why not Russia? And the only thing I could respond was, well, Barcelona doesn't have a twin city program with, you know, Shiraz.
What are twin cities? Sorry. I don't even know what that term means. Can't explain
that they, they help Israel, but I suppose it's that, but I don't know what happened.
I feel upset when I hear this kind of news. Also, it's unbalanced to what I've seen of Catalonia doing. I've been to a public like Hanukkah lightning thing in the middle of like a big square in front of like the mayor's office or something like that. And there's like a lot of like politician support saying like we embrace the Judaism and we don't want to do the things that we did in the past. So like it doesn't make sense, you know? It's like they're like contradicting. So like, what message are they really trying to give to us, the Jewish community here? Are they supporting us or not, you know?
Muchas gracias.
Thank you.
A ti, gracias.
De nada.
Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Gracias.
Obrigada.
Okay, that's all from Barcelona's Jewish community. Back to you in New York. Adeo from Barcelona.
My favorite part of the story is that Madrid has apparently been like, hey, we'll partner with them. Like, if you don't want them anymore, we'll take them.
Right. Tel Aviv is a major cat, is a major fine. When they're single again.
Yeah, like their dance card.
A lot of suitors for Tel Aviv. That's our tablet colleague, Ellie Blyer, in Barcelona. Liel, will you take us to Israel for our next story?
I will, with a disclaimer, which is we very deliberately did not fact check the news item we're about to share. I was very tempted to, but then I was also very afraid that it will turn out to be a complete fabrication. This comes to us from a Facebook group called I Fucking Love Science, which is a huge and somewhat credible Facebook group.
And a website.
As such.
There's a website, must be true, as my kids would say.
As these things go.
They read it.
We made, again, no effort to verify this whatsoever because, well, the reasons will soon be obvious. Headline, retired... Can't even read this with a straight face. Retired Israeli head of space security claims Earth is collaborating with a galactic federation. Goes the story. The former head of Israel's space security program, Chaim Eshed, has either just spilled the biggest secret in world history or is deeply delusional. Eshed allegedly claims a galactic federation has been in touch with the governments of the United States and Israel, but asks for its existence to be kept secret. He has spent 29 years as the head of Israel's space security program. He's also a professor at the Technion. And he made this claim with an interview to a big Israeli newspaper. There's an agreement between the U.S. government and the aliens, he said. They signed a contract with us to do experiments here. They, too, are researching and trying to understand the whole fabric of the universe, and they want us as helpers. First of all...
Wait, who is they? Is they America or the aliens?
They is the aliens. First of all... Could there be a more Jewish thing than the aliens having their own, basically, federation?
I was literally just thinking that. It's like, we're doing across the USA, in part with the help of the federations of North America.
We have a young leadership program here in the Galactic Federation. We raised... $180 million.
When I was in grad school, we had a reading group and we would get, you know, we'd read an article and then talk about how it made us feel or whatever.
That sounds very grad school.
Right. And there was this woman who had come to grad school after three gap years between college and grad school working for the Federation of Greater whatever, Omaha.
Greater Mars.
And periodically, and every article she read, she would then say, and the room was like two Jews, me and her, and then a bunch of Gentiles studying church history. And she would always say, this reminds me of the way they do things at the Federation. And finally, one day, this sweet guy who ended up becoming a Lutheran pastor said, excuse me, is this a Star Trek reference? He had no idea what she meant by the Federation. And she just assumed everyone knew the Federation. And he thought she was talking about the aliens.
She was talking about the Intergalactic Federation. Hey, I love this.
Wait until you meet the lionesses of Saturn. You raise 100 million
I would like to
bucks.
Do a live show at their General Assembly.
Oh my God.
Which is on Pluto?
Yes.
Galactic Federation, if you're listening, we'll cut you a very good price. Any planet of your choosing.
By the way, I think this was just like a fake out. This was like a guerrilla marketing ploy for the next season of Fauda when Daron has to go undercover on Mars to help with the Federation.
But can you imagine like the galactic? Let's assume for a second that aliens exist. I mean, I speak
mean,
as a
assume?
Very patriotic
of course
Israeli.
They exist.
Is this really the country that you would choose to collaborate with? The Galactic Federation's like, what country is really, really, you know, productive?
Has their shit together.
And hearing, like, has everything together and knows its stuff. These guys,
oh, right.
Let's go with a country that has had 17 elections in the last 3 weeks. Right. Like, those are the people.
Not
who
Switzerland,
order.
Where things are actually locked
Correct.
Down tight. Israel.
Thank you.
Our Jew of the Week this week is a returner. He's David Sachs. He's the author of Jewish classics like Save the Deli and human classics like The Revenge of Analog, which truly is one of my favorite books of all time. It's one of the books I will pay retail and buy copies for friends of mine and force it on them. He joined the three of us to talk about his most recent book, The Future is Analog, How to Create a More Human World. David, or as I like to call him, David Sachs, welcome back to Unorthodox.
It is great to be in my house still, I guess. I do recall fondly our last time we were in studio, in situ.
We were.
You know, in that glorious month of February 2020 when we're like, I guess I better wash my hands after going pee.
Right. So you mentioned in this book, The Future is Analog, which is another masterwork, and that you had to do your last book tour about your book about small businesses over Zoom. And I thought, yeah, we got you in person a couple weeks before it dropped.
You were literally the only thing I did. I did one other podcast. A guy came to my house in Toronto because he lived here. You were the only, yeah. So fond memories.
So what you're saying is you saw us in person and then a couple of days later, a global pandemic started. Coincidence?
Lab leak my ass.
So you have a lot of books behind you. We love your book on small businesses. We love your book on the past and future of the delicatessen. I, of course, you know, consider The Revenge of Analog my personal Bible. Now you're back with a New Testament to The Revenge of Analog, or as some might say, a Book of Mormon, a Latter-day Testament.
I think it's more of like a Mishnah, to be honest.
And I want you to tell us exactly the story of this book.
So, you know, let's go back to those dark days, right? It's April 2020. I am recording podcasts in the closet in the basement bedroom of my mother-in-law's lovely country house where I'm living with my family. And for every interview I'm doing for the new book that I am still birthing into the world during this thing, I'm getting requests from media all over the world, Spain, Argentina, Germany, to talk to them about what the future of analog is. Because I'd written this book, The Revenge of Analog, which really looked at an ongoing phenomenon, this sort of surprising resurgence of non-digital technologies, goods and services. Why were independent bookstores coming back? Why was everybody buying turntables again and vinyl records? Why were people writing in Moleskine notebooks? What did this say when everything was supposed to be becoming more digital? And so all these people were asking me at this time, well, what does this say for the future of analog now that this is our permanent way of being? Now that, you know, the pundits are telling us and the people in the tech industry, this is the new normal. Zoom is the new normal for work. Virtual school is the normal for education. Shopping is the new normal online. No one's ever going back to a grocery store again. What are you, crazy? And even in the Jewish world, you know, how wonderful is it that you can just sit at home in your PJs and, you know, sing Micha Mocha on a Saturday morning without having to get up and drive to shul or walk to shul. How great is that? It opened up this world of Judaism. You know how many Jews in Toronto were like, I went to services at the Park Avenue Synagogue.
I mean, basically, there were three shuls during pandemic. There was Central Synagogue, Park Avenue, and Ikar. There were three. The entire Jewish world was reduced to three mega churches.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All good shuls, by the way.
Wonderful.
But apparently, there are only three of them.
And I was just saying, there was this central assumption behind all these questions, which was like, well, the future is obviously this. We've been told this is what the future is going to be. The future is going to be digital. You're going to be doing as much, if not more, through your computers and screens. And that's where we're headed. How could you possibly believe the future is anything else? And I was just astounded because what I was experiencing was, for the most part, pretty miserable. Like, it was no future that I wanted to live in. And as I wanted my kids back at school, I wanted to go to a theater and see an actual show, not the Disney Plus production.
Right. The world ran a test and said, okay, go all digital for 2 years. Let's see how it is. This is it.
This is your A-B testing. And for the most part, you know, obviously there were certain things that people preferred and worked well. And it's great to record a podcast without having to go to a studio. It's very convenient and it works fine. But there was a disassociation. And I think the growing misery and unease we all felt in every aspect of our life, including our Jewish life, really became apparent that there was something missing. That thing I called analog, which, you know, before was like, oh, easily identifiable things, books, records, whatever. But this was the entirety of human experience as we've known it as physical beings in this world, right? Face-to-face conversations, interpersonal relationships that weren't mediated by a technology, physical spaces and the way we interact with them. And everything sensual that comes from living as a creature on this planet. And so that's what this book sort of was a response to. It's journalistic. I did, I don't know, 200 something interviews with people, but it is, you know, an argument.
The most moving part for me, and you look at seven different aspects of human existence. You look at, you know, prayer and soul life and commerce and arts and conversation and how all of them suffer in this digital world and can be better and will be better in a future analog world when we're fully analog again. The arts one was so interesting to me. And you talk about how exciting it is to see Hamilton or to go to a spoken word concert or to see a dance performance. And you point out that the arts community was phenomenal about moving online. Every kind of artistic experience pretty quickly moved online and then pretty quickly said, actually, we'd rather do it from our balconies and out in the street and not be online. And I think while there were some successes, you point to Erykah Badu as someone who actually can pull you in online in a very beautiful, magical way. You then say, look, there are very few Erykah Badus. And actually—
Yeah, her Adon Olam is amazing, by the way.
Nothing like it.
I mean, so how is it that the arts community was both a little bit successful, but ultimately had to re-engage analog?
I think that's pretty telling, right? And you know, what goes for arts goes for rabbis and schools and meetings. And I think it's that— when we go to a concert, right, we're going to hear music. And music at its essence is information. Each note, each sound is a wavelength of energy. And that wavelength of energy can be captured and transferred in all sorts of different ways. You can press it into plastic and play it on a turntable. You can digitize it into ones and zeros and have it as an MP3 that you stream through your headphones as you're sitting on the subway or driving in your car, or whatever, sitting at home in your living room. But we've known, Walter Benjamin wrote about this 100 years ago, there is a fundamental difference between the information of what that performance is. You listen to Keith Jarrett's The Colm concert, or you're actually there. Anyone who's been to a concert, anyone who's been to a play, anyone who's been to the crappiest Hebrew school production of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, which my family is going to in December. Not a Hebrew school production, a professional production. There is a fundamental difference between the lived experience of something and the informational digestion of it, right? The transfer of that thing. And that is the same reason why schools online were a failure all over the world for everyone from kindergartners to postgrad university students, because the fundamental misunderstanding of ed tech and remote virtual learning was that school is a place to deliver information. No, school is a place where relationships occur in a physical space. And in that environment full of senses and talking and feeling, you learn things. And it's the caring about the learning. And that's the same when you go to a performance. And it's the same when you go to a shul. I went to my first play in 2 years the other night. It's this wonderful production called The Shark is Broken, which is about the making of the movie Jaws. If you love Jaws, it's the greatest thing in the world. But it's not just like I could have watched some high definition streaming version of the thing and it would have been somewhat entertaining, but it's nothing compares to the real thing. And I think we lost sight of that.
You know, it's so interesting. And you wrote a piece in Tablet based on this book. It's called It's Time to Show Up. And there's a very Jewish argument for analog, it seems. And I'm just going to read you something you wrote because I found it very, 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 really moving. So you write, being Jewish is being there, wherever it is you feel Jewish, to actually go and experience, be with other Jews face to face, schwitzing in the same JCC steam room together in a way you just can't digitize, dial up, or stream through a headset you strap onto your face. And like, to me, that is really, really right. You know, I think, of course, we can all acknowledge the accessibility that virtual offerings give to a community that might not have been accommodated before. But you basically say, like, if you can do it, show up. Don't be the person on the screen in the center of the synagogue where we see everyone at home.
It's a straightforward thing. It's the thing that I missed. And yet our community, and when I say our community, I mean Reform and conservative Jews. I think the Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, were always showing up. They were, you know, they were going to like 500-person funerals in the peak of all the COVID waves. They had no problem with it.
I want to actually throw out one counterexample to you. Maybe it's not a counterexample. Maybe it all makes sense. It does seem that everyone I know who does want to marry and have sex and procreate now meets their partner online. Is that like the one thing that actually digital turned out was fabulous for? Is that you're in a big city, you're sick of the bar scene, you feel you're meeting the same people over and over again, But, you know, if you want to find the other person in the world who thinks that The Assistant by Bernard Malamud is the best book ever, Match.com or whatever they're using these days will help you find that person. Like, was that actually a net plus for society?
Listen, I think there are many advantages to digital technology. This conversation we're having now, which again, would have been very difficult.
So delightful.
If not impossible to do remotely previously, right? The fact that I can connect with people and wrote this book from home and the fact that you can, as a publication, reach out and read articles and thoughts from Jewish people around the world, hear music, order food, whatever you want to do. But it's not exactly a substitute, right? It's not the everything. For some people, it works out great. Other people talk about the difficulty of the online dating and how it's, you know, my brother's single and he said it's just like, it's exhausting. That it's endless streams of messages and a fire hose of sort of things and then people just ghost you. It's like 90% of the people like write you back once and never reply. And it's not a perfect thing. And I think that's it. It's pushing against this idea that digital is this utopian ideal. And I think there's a lot of people in the Jewish world that thought that this is the solution for shul engagement or Jewish community engagement, that the young people are online. We got to get online with the young people, right?
Explain this to me. So why would people in so many spaces in the arts and Jewish life, et cetera, who really ought to have known better, really ought to have known that the essence of the experience is analog, go so quickly and so enthusiastically the route of, oh yeah, let's do digital?
I think there is this peer pressure in a way, a fear of missing out, a fear of being left behind as the world and modernity sort of moves up. And I think we saw these examples over the past decade and a half to 20 years of these companies and these technologies, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon, just blowing everything in their way out of the water, right? And this was the future. And anything that wasn't part of that was just going to be crushed and left in the dust. And there was sort of a fervor behind that. And I think for people or institutions that were struggling or searching for identity or searching for solutions, it provided a very easy and sort of, I don't know, purchasable answer to that. Oh, well, I guess the future of engagement has to be online. The future of Jewish culture is digital. Let's invest in these things. And there's been good things that have come out of that. No question. Tablet is a great example, right? But again, it's not the only thing. And I think if it comes at the expense of the thing that makes us who we are, that embodied sense of Jewishness, a people that are part of a world and a community and relationships and the way we interact with that is most meaningful when it is physical and visceral and real, then we've missed the boat, right? And so that attraction is its simplicity.
Sometime before this conversation ends, I wanted to talk about social prescribing. Is that what it was called? It was this thing in England where basically professionals found friends for you. And it was both very moving, but also made me think, what has broken in us that these people can't find friends themselves? What was social prescribing?
Social prescribing is a practice that emerged, I guess, in the past 20 years out of the National Health Service in the UK. And they were looking at the rising problem of isolation and loneliness and how it was leading to all these other issues in people's physical health, people who had diabetes and heart disease and substance abuse issues and issues with whatever was going on in their life, right? And they were going to these medical clinics and the doctors were like, look, there's not much we can do for these people. There's not a lot of drugs we can give them. What these people really need is to come in and talk to someone. They actually need friendship because they're just isolated and alone. And there's been this rise of this around the world and there's all sorts of reasons for it. But I think the most obvious one is like the lifestyle we have built in the world as it's become more modern and as it's become more mediated through computers and digital technology is one where people are increasingly isolated. You could sit in your house and never leave it and just click and talk to people and get everything you need brought to your door. And that is a dangerous thing. And so social prescribing brings them together with social workers and community centers, and it prescribes socialization in a way that actually gets these people to feel comfortable. So it could be a baking club or a gardening group or a group that does nature walks once a week or some other thing, right? And you think about these, the loss of the third place in the Jewish community, the men's clubs and the women's auxiliaries and Hadassah and the Schwitzes. I mean, we could sit Sheva for the Schwitzes.
Liel's a big Schwitzer, actually. You're preaching to the moist.
Almost every week.
Where?
Brooklyn.
Oh, Coney Island. Interesting. Interesting.
Brighton Beach.
Oh, interesting. Avenue X.
We got to get to that Toronto Schwitzian.
The Toronto Schwitzian, yes. There is, I'll tell you about the ambassador. Anyway, the lack of the third place thing, right? We've lost this place where people will just naturally come together, right? We don't have the necessity to go to Goldfarb's meat market every day because you can go to Costco once a week or just put on your Fresh Direct order and get your kosher meat delivered to your home. You don't have to walk to shul every day like all the people do in the PJ Library stories that my kids get because you just go once a week or you call it in or whatever. That sense of like the places where you would come together and talk to people and maybe it's just, oh, hi, Stephanie, good morning. How are you? Know what's happening? Oh, my back, you know, whatever. And that builds your sense of who you are in the world.
I love that, by the way, your first kind of instinct in this like wordplay was a complaint. What's happening? Oh, my back.
I think we're all amongst our people here. So let's be honest, right?
If you were to leave our listeners, the J. Crew, with a lesson or two on how to be, how is one to be if we've forgotten how coming out of the pandemic?
It's what I said in that story I wrote for the website. Show up, right? Be there. That's how you have to be. In the places in your life where it matters. If, you know, I'm not saying show up and like, instead of writing emails, read everything to people in front of their houses. Do the things that make sense to you to do when it's convenient digitally. But when the things that matter in your life, whether they're for work, whether they're for your family, whether it's part of your Jewish life or your other aspects of it, the things that are going to be the most meaning, the things that you actually experience with your full body. So show up.
David Sacks, author of The Future is Analog. You're my
favorite.
Thanks
for showing up.
Thank you for being here now, as a great man, as a great Jew once said. Thank you for being
on
Jew of the Week.
Was that it? Yeah.
Next year in Toronto. Broadway comes to the 14th Street Y on Tuesday, May 21st. Join us at 7 p.m. for a conversation with cast members from Prayer for the French Republic, the Tony Award-nominated Best Play. Tony nominee Betsy Adam and fellow cast members Frances Benhamou, Ethan Haberfield, and Ari Brand will take part in a lively discussion moderated by the New York Times' Mark Tracy. They'll talk about the play's themes of Jewish identity, French culture, and Zionism in times of rising anti-Semitism. This event is part of 14Y's spring season of Jewish culture. As a Jewish community center, 14Y offers a variety of opportunities for people to discover, explore, and connect with Jewish life. Visit 14streetY.org to learn more and purchase tickets to Broadway at 14Y. Hey, J.Crew, it is time for some pod biz. Tonight, May 16th, I will be moderating a Zoom conversation with Rabbi Sharon Brous and Shai Held about each of their new books. That's at 6 p.m. Eastern and the final event in my Unpacking the Book series with the Jewish Book Council and the Jewish Museum. This one's on Zoom, so no matter where you are, I hope you can make it. And tonight is actually a doubleheader for me. If you're in the New York area, I'll be at the Marlene Meyerson JCC Manhattan at 7:30 tonight in conversation with Israeli rapper and singer Jimbo J. He'll be performing and there will be delicious Israeli food from Chef Mushka, who made the famous harosets at our Passover pop-up. You can find links to register for both of those events at tabletmag.com/unorthodoxlive. We also have some great events coming up for Tablet members in person and on Zoom. On May 16th, Catherine Wolf will be in conversation with Jews who refuse to back down against hostile crowds in various arenas, from municipal buildings, school board meetings, and of course, college campuses. She'll be talking with Club Z's Masha Merkalova, Safe CUNY's Avraham Goldstein, Attorney John Kovac, Mel Waldorf, Steve Goldberg, and UNC Chapel Hill student Daniel Stumpel. Also coming up, a warm and intimate Zoom for those who have lost friendships since October 7th. That's on May 21st and will be a great chance to connect and meet new people. And on May 30th, an in-person Tablet meetup in Washington, D.C., hosted by Tablet's executive editor Wayne Hoffman and Catherine Wolf. That'll be at Char Bar at 6 p.m. You can become a Tablet member at tabletm.ag/UOmember and get more information about all of these events. Okay, back to the show.
To the mailbox, first of all, some of you may remember that last week we answered a letter that John Matthew IV had written to Robert Scaramuccia about the newsletter. Robert had said, are you the J. Crew? Are you J. Crew? How do I address all of you? And John Matthew IV said, as a Gentile, let me just say, I'm happy to be part of the J. Crew. Then Robert posed the question, does J. Crew have a hyphen? And John Matthew IV, who is angling to be the Gentile of all time on our show, I think he wants an invite. He writes back and says, dear Unorthodox, definitely go with the hyphen. Thank you, John Matthew IV.
The fourth.
Quad. We're calling him Quad.
If John Matthew IV ever becomes Pope, I don't know if he's Catholic, but he doesn't even have to change his name.
No.
He's already Pope John Matthew IV.
Pope John Matthew IV. If you want to drink a little what John Matthew IV is drinking, subscribe to the newly revamped and beautifully written newsletter by going to tabletm.ag/unorthodox newsletter. Stephanie, I believe this next letter is for you.
I am so glad to hear the careful way Julia Whalen, one of your recent guests, finds out about pronunciations. I listened to A Book of Longings by Sue Monk Kidd, which is about Jesus and the possibility of his having had a wife. There were not a lot of Hebrew words in it, but it's early Judaism, and he goes off to the caves to say the Shema, except the reader pronounces it Shema with a long E and accent on the first syllable numerous times.
The greatest superhero ever.
Shema,
princess of power.
I wrote to the publisher explaining the importance of the word and suggesting that the author would want to know if she didn't know already, and if they were going to reproduce or put out more versions, that they correct the pronunciation. I wish the reader had been as careful as Julia. Regards, Susan Stock.
Shema Yisrael.
He went to say the Shema.
Shema.
That's bad.
That's bad.
That's a lot to take in.
So guys, for those of you who think the Jews dominate media,
it's Medea.
Nobody caught it. All it went through, there was a director, there was an engineer, there was a reader, there was an author. Nobody said, wait a second. Well, folks, it's Shema. No, actually, it's Shema.
I'm a Shema. Right. I'm a Shemama. Instead, I'm not an Ima, I'm a Shema. Finnegan is our Gentile of the Week. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he reports on issues of international conflict, war, and poverty. And he's also an avid surfer, which he wrote about in his memoir, Barbarian Days, Surfing Life. Here's Mark's conversation with William Finnegan about all that and more.
William Finnegan, thank you for being on Unorthodox.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So I've been fanboying about your work in a very undignified way on this show for a very long time. It seems to me that you write, broadly speaking, about two things. One is systemic injustice and oppression of the worst kind. And the other is beautiful outdoor sporting. So surfing or rock climbing. And I'm curious if those are at all one sensibility in your mind, or if they're just kind of two muscles that get to trade off and one saves you from the darkness of the other.
I think to sort of the latter. I was just in El Salvador a couple of weeks ago, surfing. But El Salvador is a very tough country, really poor, terrible gang and crime problems, and kind of living off remissions from the U.S. So I found myself surfing in the mornings early when it was glassy and not too hot. And then in the middle of the day, kind of reporting, going around talking to people about the political situation, which is kind of extraordinary there. And in the evenings when it cooled off and the wind dropped, surfing again. It was a good balance.
I feel like when I've done really intense reporting, that's exactly what I need is morning surfing and evening surfing. And of course, I don't surf. By the way, before I forget, I'm 48 years old and I've never stood up on a surfboard. Should I bother at this point?
Well, if you're dying to do it, you can manage it at the right place at the right time. Maybe with a teacher or something on a beginner's board in the right kind of waves. But it's if you want to surf a lot or surf well, it's too late.
I knew that's the answer, and because I think you've written as much, and yet I had to hear it from you myself. Speaking of surfing and aging, I mean, you talk at the end of Barbarian Days a little bit about your body slowing down, and I remember there's a kind of poignant part where you say that you're finally swimming laps, which the real surfer in you would never have done. You would never have swum back and forth just for exercise. And, you know, that was coming up on, I don't know, 10 years ago now. Is there an yet another chapter to surfing? Like, how does one surf as a man? What are you, 60-ish?
69.
Oh, my.
It gets worse and worse. I mean, at the time I finished Barbarian Days, I was still fighting off getting what's called a longboard, which is much easier to paddle and surf and catch waves on than a shortboard, where you have to be quick and strong. And I'd been on a shortboard most of my life, and it was getting to be time. And finally, on a Father's Day, maybe 5 years ago, my wife and daughter said, they gave me a longboard for Father's Day. They said, "You're an old man, Dad. Come on." But it's a long, slow, miserable process of, as surfers would say, becoming a kook again.
So how does that work then? You hear that there's going to be a great swell, and obviously you want the New Yorker to pay for you to go catch it. Do you then find a hook to get the New Yorker to pay your way? And do your editors know you're doing that? Like, what's the transactional process by which you get them to foot the bill for your surfing life?
This is a vexed question, although it didn't come into play on this trip, which the New Yorker did not pay for. But I have had even another trip to El Salvador. I went actually during the Civil War to cover an election, which was quite a violent thing. And when the reporting was done and I filed my story, I actually went off the clock and went down to the coast and surfed to kind of wash off the misery of the events I'd covered. But yeah, on other stories, I have been able to you know, go to Western Australia and do my reporting on, you know, the iron ore boom there, but also get in some waves. And not really discuss it too much with my editors.
You know, you've written two books, one that I keep rereading and one that I've taught. I've worked with Cold New World in classrooms, and I keep rereading Barbarian Days. And if I'm not mistaken, the reporting of Cold New World, which largely takes place in the American inland in places like inland California and New Haven, came after you had kind of washed ashore from a decade or so of chasing waves and surfing. Is that more or less accurate?
Yeah, that's true. Although you mentioned the part of the book that takes place in inland California, that was in the Antelope Valley, kind of outside LA, which was a really intense place at the time. I was writing about skinheads, you know, both white supremacist skinheads and anti-racist skinheads who had a gang war going on. And it was so miserable. It was near where I grew up, and it was kind of a generation later and how life had changed, mainly for the worse in that part of California. And I breaks when I felt like I was going mad hanging around with these neo-Nazi kids, and went surfing, and, you know, just drove over the mountains to Malibu and really, really appreciated the breaks, you know, just quiet mornings, not necessarily great waves, but just to be around, you know, seagulls and waves and seals and not bitter racial hatred.
Yeah, I should say so. That gets to what I was getting at a little bit, which was I was curious about your own temperament, because the years that you describe in Barbarian Days, there was so much solitude. I mean, of course, you were traveling for a good bit of it with your friend Brian, right? But not always. You also had months at a time when you didn't really know anyone, right? Or you wouldn't encounter many other English speakers. And then a lot of the reporting you do, and I know that, I mean, I've done kind of reporting myself in tragic situations where not only are you talking to other people, but you're wallowing in other people's suffering to some extent. It seems to me that those are two very different temperaments. And I'm curious if you think of yourself as someone who enjoys being around other people or not, because I could not have handled, I can do the latter, but the solitude of the former, I think, would have really gotten to me. And yet you seem very much in your element there.
Well, it's funny you say that, because, you know, I've been surfing forever and had to kind of choose a few places and people to focus on in Barbarian Days. In every case, I wrote about places and times where I shared waves with a friend, and a lot of the book is really about male friendship, perhaps more than surfing even. And I skipped places where I did lots of surfing. In South Africa, for instance, I was posted up at one of the best waves in the world quite a lot, but I was alone, as you say, and I mean, I'd surf with other people, but no good friend. And without that kind of triangulation, without the relationship, the friendship, just saying, oh, I surfed this wave, I surfed that wave, was really quite boring on the page and didn't interest me to write about. So there is all that time alone, but there's not much, I don't find, to really to say about it. And it's in the water, if this is what you're talking about, although perhaps it's not, there is a way in which even when there are other people around, you're very much, especially when the waves are serious, it's sort of between you and the ocean, and you have to shut out everything else and pay very close attention to what the ocean's doing. The kind of reporting you're talking about where you're covering a war, a famine, like something terrible going on, and yet, I don't know, I find that by talking to people and kind of hanging around rather than just doing quick interviews about, you know, who was lost and how there was no food or that kind of thing, you get down into sort of social lives and political lives that are rich and interesting. And I rarely find myself completely kind of undone by what people have suffered, even when it's incredibly dramatic and incredibly terrible. There's usually some resilience, something going on with people that is interesting, if only their construction of what has happened and the longer you hang around, how that changes and changes. And it's, in some ways, in poor countries, which is what I'm thinking of, it's a kind of richer interaction than it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, you met people and slowly in your 20s, you began, it seemed to me, to craft the idea that you could write for a living and that a lot of these people you met, like the children you taught in South Africa, would be stories. It seems to me you started off in the book thinking, I just want to surf a lot. And maybe that's my misreading of it. And then at some point you came upon a whole box of New Yorkers, I think, and began reading your way through them. And then when you were in South Africa, you thought, well, I could write about this. I'm curious, when along the way did you say, I want to be a writer. When I finally have to make a living, that's how I'll do it.
Actually, I always thought of myself as a writer since I was little. And my parents subscribed to the New Yorker. I read it all my life. So that box of New Yorkers that appears in Australia was just a bunch of used magazines that I found and bought for my friend Brian for Christmas at a penny a piece. And he just was leafing through them. And it was fun, actually, to look at the New Yorker from that long, long yeah. distance, from especially from the Australian outback, you know, putting the writing to that test. But surfing was this thing I did since I was a kid. And did it, you know, pretty obsessively, like most people who get into it young do. But I really didn't think about it much, didn't talk about it. I really just thought of myself as a writer and spent all my time reading and writing. And my journals are all full of that from teenage years onward, and very little about surfing. I was writing fiction in my late teens and early 20s and not really getting anywhere. I mean, you know, these huge unpublishable novels. Learning, I suppose, but not getting toward making a living. And it was only when I started writing nonfiction and discovering that you could do some quite interesting writing with nonfiction that I kind of turned. And I also turned toward politics after you mentioned the job I had teaching high school outside Cape Town. This is in the bad old days of apartheid. Super intense political atmosphere, students, the township where I worked. And it kind of caused me to make a 90-degree turn in what I was interested in from this kind of romantic fiction I've been writing to wanting to write about politics and power. So it was a sort of double turn there, but it wasn't that I hadn't thought of myself as a writer. It was just a different kind of writer.
I hope you don't get tired of these surfing questions because—
Never.
Okay. But my special entree into your work is that I'm weirdly in love with writing about surfing. Not all of it, of course. There's a lot of it that's bad, but I really love Kem Nunn's work. I like Tim Winton's work. I actually liked Daniel Dwayne's work before I knew of anyone else writing about surfing. And it seems to me a pretty small subgenre. Whenever I'm bored and I Google, you know, top 10, you know, surf magazine or something, or Outside Magazine will occasionally do top 10 books about surfing. And it's always like some, you know, rearrangement of the same 10 books. It doesn't seem to me like there are 100 books on it. It seems to me you're like a big dude in a fairly interesting and somewhat new subculture of writing. And I guess I'm curious, do you think of yourself that way? And do you read these other authors at all? Are you curious how other writers write about waves and surf culture?
Well, I read the surf websites as they now are, because most of the magazines have gone out of business. But they're very different. I mean, they're directed at surfers. So they never describe what it's like to ride a wave or anything, because everybody already knows that. Barbarian Days is written for the general public, which is just a completely different language that you use and a set of assumptions. Dan Duane's book was actually written for general readers too. But there haven't been many of those. And I was actually unaware of like a whole I don't even know if it's a subgenre, but in Australia, my book kept getting reviews, you know, not your usual surfing book. And I'd think, what is the usual surfing book?
Yeah.
and they'd even say, you know, where are the naughty bits? Where's the cocaine and the redemption and all that? And it turns out that there's a whole genre of it's mainly, I mean, surfing's more of a mainstream sport in Australia than it is in the US. And the top guys, you know, the champions and top women are, you know, big celebrities, can't walk down the street sort of thing. And each one of them gets at least one biography. And very often they contain all, you know, the naughty bits and the drugs and dissipation and then redemption. And
behind the music, behind the waves. Yeah,
and they're like some of them are people I'm really interested in, mainly because of their surfing. But I was unaware of these books, this whole shelf full of books that my book was being added to. And I there aren't that many people who write about surfing that I'm thrilled with. I mean, other surfers, yes, but I mean, that would be of any interest to the general public. I mean, to the general reader, I can't think of anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned some people you like, and I happen to like their work too. But I don't think it is a budding niche of literature. I could be wrong.
Much as I want it to be. Final question, two-parter. So what are you working on now? Maybe it's the El Salvador thing, but maybe you have something else you want to tell us about. And what are you reading now?
Actually, I'm working on a piece about Penn Station, which is, as people probably know, the big subway and rail hub in New York City, the busiest rail station in the United States, as a matter of fact, and is a huge mess, incredibly dangerous, and has Madison Square Garden squatting on top of it like a toad. And everybody wants to do something about it, but, you know, of course, billionaire developers want to do one thing and the city needs another. So I'm working on that right now. I've written about rail and the subway system and in the past. And I just reread, actually, a book that I disliked the first time, a novel by James Salter called Solo Faces.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there's a lot of good writing about climbing, and this is a climbing novel, rather short, but I didn't give it the right chance the first time I read it. I read it fast, looking for I'm not sure what, and I slowed way down this time, and I've just been absolutely loving it. It's about a kind of a blank, kind of a cipher, this guy from California who ends up in the Alps above Chamonix in France and doing these tremendous big climbs and his kind of adventures and demoralizing life in France. So James Salter, Solo Faces.
All right. I'll check it out. I tried another Salter and couldn't get through it. It was a very sexy one set in France.
A sport and a pastime.
Yes, yes. And I found it. I was at about page 100. I thought, this is pretty good smut, but I'm not really interested. But I'll try.
I thought it was great smut myself.
Okay. It was. Yeah, you're right. It was high-level smut. And I all due respect to high-level smut. Anyway, William Finnegan, thank you so much for being on Unorthodox. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mark.
Mazel tovs. I have a farewell and a welcome this week. First of all, some of you saw the obituary for Solomon Perel. He was the Jew who passed as a Nazi to survive and whose story was made into the really terrific movie Europa, Europa, which is definitely worth a watch. It's really, really haunting and a very, very, it's a beautifully done movie. And he was 97 years old. And I had always known that was based on a true story, but I didn't know the guy was alive and he no longer is. So a farewell to Solomon Perel. And a welcome to Ann Arbor listener, member of the J. Crew, Eric Jordan. He was at our live show. He just went before his Beit Din, and welcome home to Judaism. It's great to have you back to where your soul wanted to be. And it was so great of you to turn out to our show. So thanks so much and great to see you. Stay in touch, Eric Jordan.
I also have a mazel tov. It goes out to producer Josh Cross's son, Miles Cross. He just got into the University of Chicago. We are all so proud of you, Miles, and we can't wait to move you in. Liel, how about you?
So a couple of days ago, Yaakov Israel Paley, 5, and his brother Asher Menachem Paley, 7, were mowed down by a Palestinian terrorist in Jerusalem who just drove right over them and killed 2 precious boys. And I just want to say, may the memory be a blessing.
Unorthodox is a production of Tablet Studios, hosted by Mark Oppenheimer and Stephanie Butnick and Leah Leibowitz. We're produced and edited by Josh Cross, Robert Scaramucci, Quinn Waller, and Ellie Blyer, who was in Barcelona today. Our team includes Courtney Hazlett, Tanya Singer, Jeroen Ruske, and Sam Hacker. Please follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Write to us, unorthodox@tabletmag.com, or call us 914-570-4869. Get our brand new swag at tabletstudios.com. Please rate us on whatever platform service you might use. Our episode art is by Esther Werdiger. Theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Mailbox name by Steve Barton. Send us snail mail, P.O. Box 200-7999-1001. Rabbinic supervision this week by Rabbi Kimberly Herzog-Cohen at Temple Emmanuel in Dallas, Texas. And we come to you from the continually refurbished, I mean, it's just a work in progress, This beautiful room continually being outfitted with better acoustics, better furniture, better people, Tablet Studios. Shalom, friends.
And now, producer Robert Scaramuccia tries Dr. Brown's Cellray.
I mean, this looks like Dr. Brown's natural flavor. It says Cellray, and it says it's celery soda with other natural flavors.
Would you try that for me?
I don't particularly want to, but you are my boss.
You should not have it on the record of how we're pressuring.
Wow. I think it smells like celery.
Yeah.
I don't. Let me.
Oh, he's taking a second sip.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not bad. I can't tell you the last time I had celery in my life, so I can't really compare it.
You know what? Just do what this drink the celery needs mm-hmm. is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Like, he keeps celery.
Oh, I'm gonna drink the rest of it.
Drink it.
140 calories?